Welcome to At the Root of It on the 6th of April on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Erin Fitzpatrick broadcasting out of the Heritage Radio studio at Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn. And we'll begin today's show with a thank you to our sponsor, A16 Restaurant. Pizza fans and wine aficionados alike, visit A16 in San Francisco's Marina neighborhood with similar intentions to enjoy the flavors of Italy's soulful south. A16 shares a name with the highway that runs from Naples to Canosa Puglia. Chef owner Lisa Shaw oversees the menu, which features fresh pasta, house-butchered and house-cured meats, and authentic Napolitan pizza. Complementing the rustic menu, wine director owner Shelley Lindgren selects wines that highlight the indigenous grapes from Campania and nearby regions. For more information, go to www.a16sf.com. And you can listen to today's show live and via podcast or iTunes, broadcasting today at 4 o'clock and every Tuesday on www.heritageradionetwork.com. And we'll start today's show with the Week in Wine recap with latest news. Washington lawmakers are likely to impose a higher beer tax to help budget deficits. Democrat lawmakers are considering a tax increase on mass market beer, betting that beer drinkers won't mind paying a little more to bail out the state budget. The idea surfaced publicly on Monday as part of a new tax proposal from the state Senate, which is negotiating a budget balancing plan with the House and government. Chris Gregoire, a higher tax on big brand beers, microbeers would be exempt, is one of the first new revenue-raising ideas to emerge in weeks as majority Democrats work their way through difficult tax and spending negotiations. The higher beer tax at 50 cents per gallon translates to about 43 cents additional per six-pack. And in the crop report, Decanter.com reports that Sauternes 2009 is a great vintage. French journalist Michel Bétain claims that the balance of fruit and acidity is even better than 97 or 2001, also remarking that a unique feature about the 2009 vintage is the speed at which the harvest was completed. Botrytis came about the 20th of September with grapes full of ripeness, so the grapes needed to be picked as quickly as possible. And lastly, in the market feed, one more sign of India's surging growth is demonstrated by the increased popularity of wine, as reported in an article in the Vancouver Sun. A growing number of young Indians see wine tasting as a badge of sophisticated glamour in a culture where alcohol is forbidden. Primarily sold in urban centers, the market for Indian wine is roughly 12 million cases a year, and the country also imports 200,000 cases from Europe and a small percentage from Australia and the U.S. India, which is the world's largest whiskey market, is a tempting target for both domestic and international wine sellers. We will most likely easily see a growth by 30% this year, and there'll be new players in the market, which means healthy competition on a global scale. We'll take a short break and be back with my guest this afternoon, Janine Lettieri, wine director of the Waverly Inn and Garden in Manhattan's West Village.
Cuéntale al alba, cuéntale, y dile que yo voy a parar el tiempo. Dile que levante marinero, que sigue igual de loquito febrero, que las hojas de aquel árbol que plantamos no la castiga el viento. Dile que ayer noche fui villano, que juro pero a veces soy pagano, que te robé caricias sin mentiras como un buen samaritano.
Welcome back to At the Root of It. It was a little homage to Spain, considering my guest this afternoon most recently returned back from Europe from the Spanish region of Galicia and Asturias, the Basque region of northern Spain. Hello to my guest, Janine Lethierry.
Hi, Erin.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming out today. Finally, the rain has stopped and we're seeing some signs of spring out here. So it's a nice day to sit outside in the garden.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. We're having great weather. Hope it lasts.
Me too. Well, tell me a little bit about your position at the Waverly.
So I've been at the Waverly for about a year and a half. I'm the wine director there. So my job entails choosing the wines for the list, thinking about the creative direction of the list, what regions we want to feature, what vintages we want to have to offer our guests. And in addition to that, I'm on the floor a few nights a week interacting with all the guests and helping them with their wine selections.
And how long have you been there in that capacity? For about a year and a half?
Yeah, coming up on 2 years.
Time
flies.
And it seemed like you did quite a bit of, you know, change from what the previous director was doing before.
Yeah, there has been some change, you know, nothing too extreme, but maybe just opening up the list to some other regions, broader selections, some people would consider esoteric selections, but in the past it was very classic, straightforward, Burgundy, Bordeaux, lots of verticals, California icon wines. And,
sure.
You know, with the changing economy, I think it was important to bring in some lesser wines from lesser known regions at more affordable prices. Mm-hmm. And it's been fun for us because there's new discoveries along the way.
And do you find that guests are more open to discussion on and hearing what you have to say about some of these wines, that they're not just going for a trademark?
Yeah, I've been very surprised about that. Pleasantly surprised since, coming on at the Waverly. Guests are super receptive to talking about wine. They always want a recommendation. They always want a dialogue about it. And I think that's kind of changing in wine, whereas in the past people were very set in their ways and, you know, they had very fixed ideas about what they should or shouldn't be drinking. Now they seem very, very much more so adventurous.
Right. And they'll wait until they've had a chance to talk to you as opposed to just ordering blindly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is nice. It's what I'm there for.
And any particular regions that you've added onto the list recently that have sparked some curiosity?
Well, we all heard the song,
right,
during the break. So as Erin mentioned, I just came back from, I just came back from Spain. And a lot of fun discoveries there. We added a wonderful wine from Ribera Sacra, which is a really historic, unique region in Galicia that produces a wine made from Mencia, as they say in Gallego, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And that's from Di Ventura, really old vines. The gentleman who makes the wine, he's the local vet, and his family's been making this wine, these old vineyards, for generations. And he's really cleaned them up. He's brought in some outside consultants from actually somebody who produces Albarino Do Ferrero, helped him kind of revamp things a little bit.
Where did he have the funds to do that? Did he get invested for that, or is this a very modest kind of investment?
I think it's a modest investment. It's a small project. There's not a whole lot of wine to go around. It's these vineyards are incredibly steep. They all need to be hand farmed. The grapes are very much like the Mosel in Germany. The grapes need to be carted up on a trolley because they would just be, it'd be too tedious to carry them up. So we're talking about serious steep grades. So there's not a whole lot of production. It's pretty small. So I think it's just himself, his mom and his dad, who are in their 80s, going up and down this vineyard.
Wow.
And they make about three, I think we were in the winery. It's basically a garage, and I think they have three or four tanks that look to be in tons, maybe 5 tons each. So it's not a big production.
Not producing too many bottles. Yeah.
Yeah. But the wines are beautiful. They have stunning clarity. There's and purity. There's no oak, so the fruit really shines through. Mincia is sometimes compared to Pinot because it's got great acid, good fruit. To me, when I tasted it blind a few months ago, I thought of Beaujolais and Gamay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little denser, I'd say, in some ways. Now, I recall an article that Eric Asimov wrote in the New York Times about this particular region, Ribera Sacra, and just being so drawn to it. It's so unique and so off the beaten track that people didn't even really know. There wasn't much wine from this region going around in the States, I think, until just the past couple of years, it seems.
Yeah, that's true. There's been kind of a little bit of a resurgence, but like I mentioned, it's really hard to farm these areas. So when you're in the region, you're looking at some of these vineyards, you can see there's, you know, a farmed vineyard, and then right next to it, you can see the terraces and the remains of a vineyard, but it's overgrown by forest. So it's really cool to see. You kind of feel like you're lost in time a little bit when you're there. What's really interesting is that this region, we were told, was, at one time, the place that the best wines from Spain came from.
Oh, yeah?
You know, before Rioja was the classic region of Spain, this was. And I guess that was back in the late 18th century.
Yeah. Huh. Now, because I feel like everyone thinks about, when they think of northern Spain, they're thinking whites. So when you mentioned Doferrero and the Albariño, you know, how far away was that from Ribera Sacra?
You know, it's hard to say. I think it was about a 2-hour drive. I can't say for sure because we made some stops along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a couple of hours inland from the coast.
And primarily then that's red wine production area.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's pretty exclusively red.
Mm-hmm. And any other things? I know you've done quite a bit of traveling in the past year or two to different regions. Is there anything else particularly striking about wine production or just the general aspects of the climate in the region that struck you?
The thing that struck me the most was just this abundance of old vines and just the steepness of the slopes and how windy and narrow the roads were and how you really felt like you were just so far removed from civilization. It used to be that the sheep herders, the shepherds would come and work the vineyards in the summer and they would sleep, you know, they would travel, they would hike there and they would kind of camp out in these little huts in the vineyards. So no one even really lives there. Wow. I mean, now people kind of do, but it's still pretty isolated.
So in terms of how that translates to actual winemaking in the cellar, with the new investment, with some consulting wine consultants coming in to look at these wines, have you noticed any sort of shift or change or maybe traditional things being thrown out the window to adapt to more of an international style?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think each producer is different. Mm-hmm. We did visit another producer, Domino do Bebe, and they had a lot more. They were putting a lot of investment into not only the vineyards, but the wineries as well. They were experimenting with biodynamic winemaking and grape growing, and they were using really interesting fermentation vessels, some of them made out of cement, shaped like an egg to promote life and to make the fermentation have some movement. Which they thought
helped the wine along. Yeah.
Yep. And those eggs were very expensive. They were made in Germany, and I know they were about 3,000 euro for an egg, and they were quite small.
The Germans and their eggs. Hilarious.
So.
And then how has the reaction been on the customer side from this particular Mincia that you have on the list?
The guests like the wine, you know, it's fruit forward. It's really just pleasant and easy drinking. And it's, you know, it's very unlike, a lot of the things that people are used to drinking, but it's definitely approachable.
And this kind of veers a little bit off topic, but just thinking about the restaurant scenario, the restaurant environment, do you often get guests who will bring in their own wine, or do most people stay to the list?
Mm-hmm. You know, we do have a pretty extensive list. So, you know, we allow people to bring in outside bottles. We do have a corkage fee. It's a little prohibitive, to be honest.
The fee itself. Okay.
But we feel like the guests should be, you know, if they've got the special bottle in their cellar that maybe they were, you know, presented, maybe this wine was presented to them as a gift for their anniversary or their birthday, and that has some kind of, you know, value and meaning to them, mm-hmm. they should be able to enjoy that. And so we do allow people to bring their own wines in, but, you know, it's always nice. I mean, just, we've talked about this in the past, just having some, you know,
parameters.
General rules, yeah. or parameters or etiquette about it. It's always nice to call ahead if you're going to a restaurant and bring in your own bottle so that the sommelier knows. And that way they can also, if it's something very special, decant it when it needs to be decanted, have sure. it at the right serving temperature for you. So, you know, I'm sure any sommelier would want to work with a guest and make sure that their experience is as pleasurable as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I find that customers are often a little bit sheepish about it. And recently was made aware that in Nevada, in Las Vegas, particularly from people who work there, have noted that corkage is illegal by the state of Nevada. So I don't know exactly how the rules translate to New York. But it is something interesting to look at.
I'm fairly certain it is legal in New York as long as the restaurant does have a liquor license and, you know, is allowed to serve liquor on premise mm-hmm. or wine. You know, that's what makes this a very complicated issue, is that each state has its own individual laws. You take New Jersey, for example, which a lot of our guests do come from New Jersey. You know, it's right across the river. It's very close.
Sure.
Liquor licenses are very hard to come by in New Jersey. So most of the restaurants there are BYO. So it's very hard to explain to a guest that, you know, while this is very commonplace in New Jersey, in New York we do, you know, charge a corkage because it's just the way things are done there.
Yeah, no, you don't think about it. That's true.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to kind of travel the rest of your trip, because I know you started in that area and then continued northwards, I believe. So we're going to
I know this is a wine show, but I think we're going to talk a little bit about cider, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Yeah, we're going to take a short break and be back to talk about the ciderias in northern Spain. Are listening to At the Root of It. Thank you to our sponsor, A16 Restaurant in San Francisco, and to our listeners who are just joining us, please feel free to call in at 718-497-2128 with any questions or comments for my guest this afternoon, Janine Lettieri. And we will continue today's show with your travels in Spain, where we left off in Ribera Sacra, and then continuing northeast, I believe, from there.
Yeah. We We actually, before going up to Cider Country, we stopped off in Ribera at a winery called Vigna Main and had a great experience there. I know you took a look at some pictures, Erin.
Oh, yeah.
So,
gorgeous.
Yes. Too bad. The radio listeners don't get to see them.
I know.
But Erin honed in on a picture of an authentic octopus boil,
mm-hmm.
which was pretty cool. So the proprietor of Vigna Main told us that he wanted to take us to something very, very particular to the region and very authentic. And he took us to an octopus boil. So set up in the center of the town were two guys who were bringing in frozen octopus, which we were told tenderizes the octopus, from the coast, and they were boiling it.
After cutting it with scissors?
Well, first they boil it. And then these guys are very skillful. You know, imagine the best knife skills on a chef, but this guy could do it with scissors. And he would take the octopus once it was boiled, and he would cut the tentacles into little, you know, kind of nickel or quarter-shaped pieces. And that octopus would go in a bag with beautiful olive oil, really coarse sea salt, and some spicy red pepper. And that was all mixed together and then served on a little platter, and you ate it in the street with a toothpick. Or you could bring it into the local bar, which was incredibly smoky and brightly lit and looked like an off-track bedding.
The smoking bans haven't hit northern Spain yet. No.
Not quite yet.
So there was no heat on that preparation then. It was just sashimi style, essentially, but cured in olive oil? Or
No. So the octopus, when it came out of their truck, it was completely frozen solid. It went into...
They boiled it into a
giant... pot over a propane burner with a very rapid boil, and it was boiled for about 10 minutes, and then it was just dressed with the olive oil, the sea salt,
and the
spicy pepper, and it was absolutely fantastic. And the coolest thing about it was there was a line of people from the village with their pots. So they would just walk up with the pot under their arm, and they would get their octopus, and they would bring it home, and then they would center their whole Sunday meal around the octopus.
Wow.
So they would probably make some rice. And
do they pay for it, like farmer's market style, or they
farmer's
just
yeah, it's actually quite expensive. We were treated, which was really nice, but I was curious. I'm like, I wonder how much this is.
Yeah,
and it was pricey.
Yeah,
it's like for for a normal size serving, I think it was about 30 euro.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's quite pricey. But I guess it's a specialty. It's something that you base your Sunday meal around. It's a once-a-week thing.
Uh-huh. So. Excellent.
Yeah.
So then heading north to Cider Country, which is something that, you know, you don't see much of here. And I did work on a opening of a Basque restaurant or Basque tapas bar a couple of years back, and really wanted to replicate serving cider that was sourced from the U.S. and found upon a one from New Hampshire called Farnham Hill. And this was probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And I've since then seen Farnham kind of pop up in different locations. But it's interesting to think about cider as just an American drink of choice way back in the day before German immigrants came and really started cultivating the beer culture here in the U.S. But it's still... well and thriving in northern Spain.
Oh yeah, it is. It's a different style than I think most of the American ciders, or at least the ones that I've been exposed to. It's a much drier, more acidic, more rustic style.
Mm-hmm.
So we headed up to a city called Gijón, and the city sits on the northern coast of Spain. There's a little peninsula that juts out, and I think that's the northernmost part of Spain. And we visited a rather large producer called Trabanco, and this was in the province of Asturias. And we had a wonderful time there. We all, you know, there were about 15 of us on the trip, everybody in, you know, different in the wine industry in a different capacity. And we were all joking about the best day in Spain on the wine trip was the day that we didn't drink any wine. we were all so enthralled by the cider. Uh-huh. There's just so much tradition that goes along with it. It feels so
And it was new, in a sense.
And it was new. Yeah, yeah, it's good to have a little palate refresher, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we didn't get to visit really any orchards. We went to a small orchard, but it was winter, so you know, we probably wouldn't have seen anything, you know, in yeah. the peak growing season.
Sure, sure.
No apples on the trees.
What do you think about where apple orchards grow in the U.S. and seeing how that kind of lines up with northern Spain in some ways, that kind of mild, wet mm-hmm. springs and yeah, mild winters.
Yeah,
I think it's winters.
A pretty similar climate, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we visited Trabanco. They produce a lot of cider. They have these giant, giant tanks, 40,000 liter tanks.
Wow.
Which were really cool. In fact, they were made out of wood. And we were told that there's only one person in the region that knows how to make them.
Wow.
So this is
What kind of wood do you know?
I'm not sure of the type of wood. Yeah. No, I don't remember. I'm sure it was mentioned, but if I made something up, I'd be lying.
Right. Okay. But only one craftsman who can produce them that large. Is that
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So you better hurry up and teach someone.
Or just create a monopoly. I've read somewhere that 80% of production in all of Spain is based out of Asturias.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would imagine so. And it's a very popular drink, I think, with the younger people there because it's cheap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And alcohol level on this was about what?
You know, I don't know. I would imagine it's about the same as beer.
Yeah.
I think it's about 5%.
5 to 7% yeah, 5 or so.
Yeah, 5 to 7% or so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to think about from the aspect of just Spanish history and how, Franco after the Spanish Civil War had prohibited the continuation of these ciderias, mm-hmm. and most people who had to abandon their orchards to go look for more industrial work,
mm-hmm.
and then there was a revitalization of them. Mm-hmm. After the 1980s, and it seemingly has only gone up from there. So,
yeah, well, they teach somebody else how to make tanks. Yeah. There's no reason why it shouldn't continue to be, thriving.
And then, as far as the fermentation in these tanks,
mm-hmm.
I know it can range in certain styles, with also method Champenoise being used for some of the finer ciders.
Yeah, so I guess for some of the finer ciders, the fermentation is actually done in the bottle, which is what makes it sparkling, mm-hmm. as opposed to in a big tank.
So the bubbles are a little
bit... You have a finer bead,
yeah.
finer bubbles, and yeah.
And are there any new trips? I know that you're in the MW, the Master of Wine program study at the moment. Are there any new trips? I'm sure that one was very helpful for just kind of a new region to explore. And
yeah, there's there are always things on the horizon. I've been doing a lot of traveling, so
mm-hmm.
just trying to,
keep it local for
a bit. Keep it local for a bit. Yeah, but perhaps I always say that, and then things come up and I'm off.
Yeah.
So there's a possible Piedmont trip coming up, which would be very exciting, with a friend who's spent some time there, has lived there, made wine there. So we'll have a really nice tour guide there,
yeah.
and set up. Yeah, absolutely.
And how is that MW program?
So far, so good.
Yeah.
It's a lot of self-study. So, there's a lot of self-discipline involved, and... It's
a journey.
Well, it's a journey. sometimes seems like an endless journey,
yeah,
but
you've only been doing it for a couple of years. So.
I've been doing it for I'm in my second year now. So I guess in the fall I'll complete 2 years, and I think the average amount of time that a candidate's in the program before they pass the exams is 5 years. So I'm almost halfway there.
Excellent. Good. Well, good luck for you on that.
Thanks.
And thank you so much for joining us today and telling us about your trip. I know we have the beer sessions coming up following, so they'll continue talk on beer following us, which seems pretty apropos for today's show. Anything you'd like to add before you leave? Or?
No, just to say thank you to you for having me.
Absolutely. And also thank you to Jack Inslee, our producer, and Nat Wiener for orchestrating today's show, and to our listeners for joining us. We will see you next week.